Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm okay, Justin. Only it's not night.
Well, nobody else knows that.
They do now.
It's Veterans Day, so from one veteran to another, happy Veterans Day. Do we have anyone else to say thank you to, Aaron?
Yeah, I'd like to give a special thank you to Andy DiBiasso. And around episode, I think it was on episode 254 that we started using the new outro music that he created for us, which is quite excellent. And I know that we've had people writing in and asking, who made that song? Where did it come from? Does it have a title? So I was talking with Andy about it, and he's like, I think I should probably just turn that into a whole song, don't you think? And I'm like, sure, go ahead. Anyway, Andy's fantastic, and he's always been there for us. If we need any kind of music, he's the go-to guy for us.
So on tonight's episode, we're going to talk about the people we trust the most. Who do we tell all of our personal issues to? I really can't think of anyone else that I talk to the most than my own family doctor. And, you know, I tell them about all my ailments, all my most intimate details. I trust them because they're highly educated. We idolize doctors, their skills. We honor them for their life-saving efforts. You know, we put these people on pedestals. We truly think that most of them are the only thing that stands between life and death. Right, Aaron?
Right. And as we age, I would say they become only that much more important to us.
So what are we talking about tonight?
Well, tonight we're talking about a man by the name of Harold Frederick Shipman, who was a doctor in the UK. Now, oftentimes we give a summary, but we'll just say that, as Justin said, doctors are trusted. They stand between life and death for some of us. In this case, that may have cost many people their lives.
So we're going to be covering a European case because we feel like all our listeners think America is the most screwed up place on the planet. And let me tell you, the rest of y'all, you got some problems too. So we're going to spread the love around.
Harold Frederick Shipman was born in 1946 in Nottingham, England. His family life was interesting because his mother, Vera, seemed to instill a sense of superiority in her children, and none more so than with Fred. Everyone that knew him called him Fred. In the media, it seems like everyone calls him Harold. As a student, he didn't really stand out.
In fact, what he was known for as a teenager when he was in school was his ability to play rugby.
Very competitive guy.
And while he didn't really talk much, didn't socialize much with the other children, he definitely put his effort into playing rugby.
His mother was having a lot of health issues, though, at this time, going in and out of the hospital and having doctors visit the home, right?
Right. When he was 16 years old or so, his mother was diagnosed with lung cancer, and the doctor was making regular visits to the home to treat her with morphine for her pain. The reason why she was being given morphine for her discomfort was because there were no treatments at the time for cancer. Nowadays, we have chemotherapy. We have other things that they can try. But back then, it was, let's manage your pain. Let's manage your discomfort. And it seems as if Fred was very much paying attention to this process, probably admired this doctor, or at least decided right then and there that he wanted to become a doctor himself.
Well, this guy comes into the home, has this prestige about him. Everyone respects him. He's highly educated, and he's helping his mother. Why wouldn't you idolize that?
Now, Fred and his mother were very close. When Vera was diagnosed with cancer and she was becoming very unwell, Fred was there for her the whole time. When he got out of school, he would head straight home to take care of his mother. He was her caregiver. When Vera died on June 21st of 1963, she was just 43 years old. It probably was pretty hard on the family, probably pretty hard on Fred.
There was some odd behavior when his mom died. I had read that the day she had died, somebody asked, well, what are you going to do now? You know, are you okay? And he said, well, I'm going to go for a run. And it was sort of a, I don't know, a deassociation, I guess. At the same time, his fellow teammates on the rugby team started noticing that he was sniffing a lot, which is pretty much slang for huffing or snorting different chemicals, whatever. And this one was Sloan's liniment,
which is made with capsaicin from the chili pepper.
It sounds kind of gross to me, but whatever. Maybe that was a crutch for him at an early age.
But as we said, he definitely seemed very interested in becoming a doctor. He took exams to try and get into Leeds University Medical School, but he failed. He went back and he took the exams again and passed and was accepted into the university. In 1965, he's accepted into the university. Within a year, he meets the love of his life. Primrose Oxtoby was riding the same bus that he was. They were both traveling to Leeds, and Primrose was pretty quiet, I think. She probably wasn't very extroverted, so Fred was the one to strike up a conversation. And she became very much in love with him in a short period of time. Her family, though, were, from what I understand, very strict Methodists, and they weren't too happy with her relationship with Fred. And then when they found out that she was pregnant and that she was planning to get married, I think that was a real problem for them, because on one hand, she needs to be married. She can't be an unwed mother.
Yeah, that's the wrong order of events to happen in that family.
But they don't really like Fred. Maybe they just get a bad vibe about him. Primrose worked as a window dresser at the time. It's not too much longer before her family help her move into an apartment with Fred. The relationship is going. They're getting married. At this point, they're just doing damage control, probably. They have no other options left in their mind. So they help them get an apartment, and Fred and Primrose move in together.
They have their firstborn child, Sarah Rosemary Shipman. Fred is finally taking his finals a few years later and graduating from his university.
Yeah, he graduated with an MBCHB, which is a Doctor of Medicine, Doctor of Surgery degree. It's a bachelor's degree.
They have a second child, Christopher Frederick Shipman. That's in 1971.
In 1974, Frederick Shipman joins his first practice in Yorkshire, England. But it's the same year that he starts to suffer from some kind of a medical issue himself. He's falling down. He's having a lot of problems, and they're guessing that it's epilepsy, that he has epilepsy. And his wife, Primrose, is there for him. She starts driving him around to his appointments so he can visit patients. That's one of the things Fred would do, is he would actually visit his patients at home if necessary, because he was there for them. And his patients very much appreciated that.
But because he had epilepsy and he was fainting or having blackouts, he couldn't drive himself. His wife would do all the footwork for him.
In 1975, it comes out that he's actually addicted to pethidine. It's an opioid synthetic that is used typically during childbirth to relieve pain.
One of the things he focused on was child health care. So he is around these drugs and he knows what they do.
And pethidine is typically injected into the thigh, and it's supposed to act more quickly than other opioids. His partners at this practice, they don't like this at all. Here's a doctor who is illegally using a drug for his own purposes and had gotten everyone concerned because they thought something was actually wrong with him. But it turns out he's just addicted to this painkiller, and they want him out, and they do get him out. And from there, Fred will go into rehab.
So his first year out as a doctor, he's already getting kicked out of his first practice. It's not a good start.
While he's in rehab, he is arrested because this was all illegal. He was forging documents, forging prescriptions to get the pethidine. And so in 1976, he pled guilty to obtaining controlled drugs by deception. He was convicted of unlawful possession of pethidine, dishonestly obtaining the drugs, and forgery of a National Health Service prescription. Now, in England, their healthcare system is the National Health Service. And to get a prescription, it has to go through them. So he's committing forgery.
He's padding other people's prescriptions, adding more doses to it than needed, and then scraping those off the top. Or he's writing fake prescriptions to people and then just keeping them for himself. But this is before the computer time, and there's no such thing as a networked database. So this is all paper and pen, and it's really hard to catch on to these things or find the discrepancies. But they are regulated drugs, so they did catch him eventually.
In the end, he had to pay fines, and the GMC, which is the General Medical Council, told him that if he screwed up again like this, that they would take further action. The General Medical Council is basically a register of medical practitioners in the UK. So if you're a medical student, this is what sets the standards by which you're educated. If you're a doctor, this is what allows you to practice. If they decide you can't be a doctor anymore, you're out.
They'll revoke your license.
Let's talk about the pethidine addiction for a moment. Pethidine, from what I understand, because it's an opioid, it can make you feel spaced out. It can make you feel euphoric. Why would he be abusing the pethidine? Do you think this is a holdover from the loss of his mother? Do you think that being a doctor and having access to these medicines, that he was curious about what these patients were going through?
Are all of the above. These things can be vices. They can be used to cope with your loss. Or he's just a drug abuser and he doesn't need a reason. He just has access, and why not?
Yeah, that access is a whole different thing. And being a part of a practice is probably why he was caught, because the medicines are heavily regulated. So it's not just him. He has other doctors around him that he's working with. Although at the time, he didn't really socialize with these other doctors too much. They were all kind of independents. It's really surprising to me. I guess if he had never had any issues, if he didn't have these blackouts, no one might have suspected that he was abusing any drugs. He went into rehab and he was not practicing medicine for a total of about a year and 264 days, or almost 2 years. But in 1977, he becomes a clinical medical officer at the Southwest Durham Health Authority. And in less than a month, he leaves this new position for Donnybrook House, which is a new practice in Hyde, England. It's there that he would remain practicing as a doctor, becoming very well liked, until 1992. In fact, his patients loved him so much that he had thousands of patients that only wanted to see Fred Shipman.
Yeah, he was very professional, very kind, and he would do the house calls, which I'm sure other doctors do that, but this is getting up into the late 80s, early 90s. That's a little unheard of, but they really enjoyed his company, and they would follow him from office to office or always request him.
Well, follow him they did, because his fellow doctors found him to be a bit of an egomaniac, and that the way he would talk to them, it seemed like he thought he was superior. Again, his patients loved him, and he seemed to treat them very, very well. In 1992, he started up his own practice, which has been described as being just yards from Donnybrook. So he literally opens next door. He has thousands of patients that move with him.
So that's a total jerk move to do. If you were working at a salon and then you opened up another salon right across the street and then took all your clients with you, or you worked at a tattoo parlor and then you opened up another one, whatever the case may be, it's a total jerk move, and it's mud in the eye of his old practice because he thinks he's better than them and that he can put them out of business.
But that's possible. Knowing his motivations, we're not sure, although, like I said, he did act superior to his fellow doctors. And so when he moved and started his own practice, one way to look at it is he could just be moving on up. He feels that he should be running the show. On the other hand, yeah, maybe he doesn't care for other people, the other doctors. And so he's saying, screw you, I'm taking all of the clients with me. But either way, it is described as sort of a sudden thing. Now, because he opened his new practice, he needs equipment. And to get this equipment, his patients help him out. They make a lot of donations. And the amount of donations comes out to about 20,000 pounds. That's dedication. That's loyalty.
Yeah. Kickstarter and Indiegogo before you had that.
And in that time, he's had a couple of more children with Primrose in the 70s and in the early 80s. So he had four children in total. Now, in a contrast to when his mother died in the mid 80s, when his father passes, Frederick seems unaffected. He doesn't seem to even really take notice that his father died. I mean, we don't really hear much about his dad, so it could be that they just didn't have much of a relationship.
At this time, he's seeing a lot of elderly patients, taking care of patients in nursing homes, and he's really focused on their end-of-life care. One woman, Kathleen Grundy, who is 81 years old, but she is 81 years young because she's very active in the community. She helps other businesses. She volunteers. Everybody knows this woman. She is highly regarded in the public. And Shipman ends up taking her on as a patient, but she doesn't really have a lot of problems. So he has to come up with something to treat her, right? He tells her that he wants to give her a blood test as part of a study for elderly people and their health and health effects of different drugs and different things. And she agrees because she says, hey, I'm healthy. I don't have any illnesses or diseases, so let's do this. And he gets her to sign a document, a release form.
Frederick Shipman was known to do everything. He would perform surgery when he felt he needed to. He was a general practitioner, but he would perform surgery. After all, he has his degree. You would think that he would hand off surgeries to people who did it all the time, but sometimes he would do the surgeries himself.
During one of these surgeries, he had to ask some people in the office to sign off as witnesses to this medical procedure. And he was in the middle of a surgery and he grabs two people from the hallway and says, hey, can you sign this document real quick? And they both sign off and they don't even look at the document because, well, hey, he's in the middle of surgery. This has to be done right away. I just need two witnesses to verify.
Dr. Frederick Shipman visits Kathleen Grundy at home and he wants to draw her blood as part of a study. She's very willing to do that. She wants to help out. So he takes out a needle.
He leaves after the blood is drawn and her family will come home later and find Kathleen Grundy has passed away at home sitting in a chair.
But it seems off to them because, for one, she seemed to be in great health. And two, she's sitting in a chair where she wouldn't have a view of the front. That's a problem because she would sit in a chair where she could see who was coming. She liked to greet people before they even got to the front door. But in this case, she has her back to the front and it just doesn't feel right.
It's not the chair she normally sits in. It's facing the wrong way. It's just an odd situation.
Kathleen Grundy has a daughter, Angela Woodruff, and she's a lawyer. She finds out that there's a new will. This doesn't seem right either because she had already had a will that was provided to her by her mother 10 years prior. So there was already a will in place. So what would have changed? Why would she change the will? Not only that, but the will leaves the bulk of the estate, which is well over 300,000 pounds. I think it's 386,000 pounds.
Yeah.
To Dr. Frederick Shipman.
And this will was signed, notarized, filled out.
It's official.
Right before her death.
So what changed? Now, for Angela, it's not even really about the money so much because their family had money. But her mother's found in the wrong chair. She was in good health and suddenly she's dead after a doctor visit. And then that doctor who was the last one to see her alive is now getting the bulk of her estate. I mean, the only way that that money would go back to the family is if something happened to Frederick Shipman where he couldn't get the money or he died.
She tracks down the witnesses who signed off on this will, and she finds a man named Paul Spencer, who was in the office, says he was just a bystander, and he was given this paper that was actually folded over, so he didn't even see what it said on it, and was told that it's a medical release form that he just needed to be a witness for. And he says, I had no idea that I was signing a last will and testament by any stretch of the imagination.
So that's in August of 1998. Kathleen Grundy had died in late June of 98. Because of Angela Woodruff tracking this stuff down and figuring out what happened, it isn't long before the authorities move on Dr. Frederick Shipman. And he's arrested on September 7th of 1998. The following year, he'll go on trial for murder.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
So I'm thinking he saw that this elderly lady was rich. He thought, maybe I could get this last will and testament and make some money. I can get away with this opportunity, right?
yeah, it seems like a hell of an opportunity. It's a lot of money. But the other problem is, it turns out that he had been investigated earlier because of concerns. It seemed as though he had many more patients dying than what was expected or normal.
His last group that he had worked with, his patients died at almost 2.5 to 3 times the rate of any other doctor in his practice. Also, he seemed to be present at all of their deaths. He seems to be visiting them at their homes when they pass. And the other doctors that were questioned, some of them had been practicing for 30, 40 years and had never been present when a patient had died, had never had a patient die in surgery. Lots of red flags are popping up here. Not that it's impossible, you know, as a doctor, you're going to be around people that die, you're going to be around sick people, but at the rate he was very questionable.
There are those that tried to figure out how this made sense, and they would say that, well, maybe he was just that attentive a doctor that he was showing up to their homes when they weren't doing well and just happened to be there when they died because he was just giving that extra care. He was staying late at the practice and he was visiting homes at a higher rate than the other doctors were. But again, we're talking numbers here. And when you have 2.5 times the number of patients dying who you're caring for than the other doctors, there are people that are going to notice.
Also, he was there to sign all their death certificates. And a lot of these people were cremated before an autopsy was even performed because they were told by Dr. Shipman they passed away old age, or they passed away in surgery, natural causes. Here's the death certificate. We can just make this quick and easy. No major process to follow here.
With the high rate of cremations, it could be said that a lot of his patients didn't have money for burial, things like that. Cremation will be cheaper. But doctors in the UK at the time, although today it's a different form, but back then it was Form B. And it was an authorization for cremation. The doctor was signing off saying, yes, I authorize this cremation. Because normally, if there's a sudden death, just as in the case of Kathleen Grundy or some of the other patients who had died under his care, it was unexpected that they died. There wasn't this battle with cancer or something that was leading up to their death. And so typically what a doctor is supposed to do is say, this death was kind of odd. I'm not sure about this, so I'm going to refer the death over to the coroner. But he wasn't sending most of these reports over to the coroner, notifying them about a suspicious death for them to investigate, like other doctors would. Other doctors would have said with Kathleen Grundy, well, that's odd because she seemed so healthy. She cared so much for those around her and was very involved in taking care of other elderly people because she was doing well, much better than they were. And she was there for them. Such a kind person. Why would she suddenly die like this? It's suspicious. They would have referred this over to the coroner, but Dr. Shipman didn't. So this is where you start to see this horrible truth as the curtain's being pulled back of this doctor who is not sending these reports over to the coroner so that the coroner can investigate these deaths. Also, this Form B, when filled out, means that Dr. Shipman would get paid between 20 and 30 pounds per Form B that he filled out. And if you have hundreds and hundreds of these, well, that adds up. And especially, I mean, in today's money, that's more like 60 or 70 pounds. And there's a slang term for this. It's dubbed ash cash.
Ash for cash. That's weird.
It's so unsettling when you think about it. And I've also read that some in the government want this changed because literally the doctor can fill this out and then it gets charged possibly to the funeral director. And then they pass that on to the family of the deceased, which is disturbing because now they're having to foot that bill, whereas some of those in the government would like to see this become a cost that the government picks up, and then it's just kind of taken care of through taxation. This is what allowed Dr. Frederick Shipman to basically not have anyone asking any questions about these people that are dying. And as far as we know, Kathleen Grundy is the one where there was a forged will involved. there was a person that he had cared for previous to that who had told him that he would be included in the will, but then it turned out it wasn't. So you wonder if that was the precursor where, you know what, I'm just going to make this happen because I want this money. Is it possible that Dr. Frederick Shipman, for all the love he got from all these patients, these loyal patients that loved him so much, that in reality, he didn't really love them? In fact, one of the things that comes up is, what if early on, Dr. Frederick Shipman was just helping some of these people along because, well, they're going to die and I don't want to be bothered with them anymore?
As the police and investigators start to peel this back, since it was into the 90s, he did have a computer system in his office. They start finding a lot of discrepancies in all of his entries. They start finding how many people died under his care. And early on, they start to look at his early patient counts. And some of them had no prior health condition, yet they die under his care. And that's the problem, is this is really sticking out. And there was an undertaker that actually brought this up to authorities and was trying to raise the alarm bells early on. And that was leading up to Kathleen Grundy.
When they investigate the computers, everything is timestamped. So they can see where patient dies, but then later after that, or even before it, a new entry is put in, now giving them some sort of ailment or disease or something. And because these deaths aren't being investigated, I mean, he can say whatever he wants. He can put whatever he wants into the computer system. And the only reason this is a problem for the investigators is because everything is timestamped. So they can see where even after a death, he goes back into the computer system and types up some sort of explanation leading up to it, trying to say, well, okay, so if she died on June 24th, I'm now putting in on June 25th an entry for June 21st saying, uh-oh, patient is blacking out or they've been falling down. They're complaining of a massive amount of pain in their chest. It's whatever he wants to put in there because, well, he's in charge.
But his grasp on computers is about as shaky as Dennis Rader's. So he doesn't understand that they can go back through and backtrack all of his entries. And then when they find a pattern, they can even go back to a lot of his paper documents and start looking through those and finding all of his victims at this point that die under suspicious circumstances.
But to go along with the discoveries they made about the computers and his notes and his entries that he made that were timestamped, they also discovered that a lot of these people that had died under his care were found fully dressed. It just wasn't normal. You know, typically if someone's dying, that you picture them in a hospital or at home in bed and they're not doing well. These people were living their normal lives and some of them weren't even elderly. So it's not even an old age thing where, and that's one of the things he would say sometimes is, oh, she died of old age or he died of old age. When in reality, that's not what happened. But when you have so many of his patients dying and then being cremated, now you can't go back and exhume that body. There is a lot of evidence against Frederick Shipman. And the earlier investigation, I think the reason it failed was because they didn't take it seriously. In fact, they didn't even want him to know about the investigation, which I think is a problem because it's sort of like, well, we're going to keep this hush-hush and we're going to do it behind the scenes and no one's really going to know about it. I mean, how successful can that be? I mean, once again, I wonder if it's, let's trust the doctor on this.
That's exactly what it is. And doctors are, I don't know if they're a tight-knit group, but they do respect each other and each other's practices. I've seen that with my own eyes with my mother getting a botched surgery, and the doctor that fixed the surgery didn't want to say anything about the prior surgery. And this is just a broken arm, but they're very protective of each other and their practices. And it's a doctor, so they are well-regarded in our society, and we don't question them.
Because of the amount of evidence that they have and because of Kathleen Grundy's death, they started getting permission from different families to exhume their deceased loved ones. And, you know, some people didn't want their loved ones exhumed. It was a difficult choice for them to make. And I've even heard one of those who were in that position talking about it and saying that they weren't against their loved one being exhumed. It's just so difficult to make that decision. It's that whole idea of we put them to rest and now we're disturbing them. And for some, death is just not a very comfortable topic, especially when it comes to their loved ones, to their grandma or their mom or dad.
They're in a better place and they're not going to be questioned about this.
They were able to figure out that Dr. Frederick Shipman, he had been overdosing them with morphine.
And even more interesting is they're finding that he's prescribing morphine, huge amounts to patients, overprescribing them. And when I first read about this, I thought, well, he had a prior drug addiction. So he's padding patients' prescriptions and, you know, using it himself. But morphine and other opiate drugs are highly regulated. So if you're having to use large amounts of morphine to kill people, well, how are you going to get that into your office? How are you going to get that supply?
And one of the discoveries they make is that there was a patient of his who had padded prescriptions for morphine.
So Dr. Shipman, during the investigations, will say things like, these people were old, it was their time. He sort of tap dances around invoking euthanizing people, but he never says he did anything wrong. I won't say I understand that point of view, but when he was saying these things, some of his past patients were giving him a pass and not accepting the fact that he could have been capable of doing something like this. But one of his patients, a man named Jim King, was diagnosed with cancer. And again, at the time, they had just come up with chemotherapy, and Jim was going to these sessions, and they were very painful, and the cancer he had was bladder and prostate cancer. So Shipman was getting morphine for him to control the pain. Jim was going to different hospitals and seeing different doctors, and a couple of them said, I don't think you have cancer. And he was like, no. My doctor, Dr. Shipman, is, done all the diagnosis, everything I need to know. And it's a little hazy on whether Shipman was the original diagnosis or if he was given that diagnosis and then Shipman ran with it. But Shipman is giving him morphine for the pain. Some of Jim's family is coming in and saying, we need to stop with the morphine because he's having bad reactions, like he's convulsing, he's vomiting, he's going through withdrawal, then getting the morphine, and it's just a really terrible scene. And this goes on for many months, up to a year. Jim's father is questioning what's going on here. And Jim's father will visit Shipman, and he will succumb to a mysterious death. So Jim's own father is now passed away after seeing Dr. Shipman. Meanwhile, some of the other doctors are like saying, well, how much morphine is he taking? And his loved ones, his family say some ungodly amount. And they said, what is that, a week or a month? And the family's like, no, that's a day.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/genY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/genY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/genY.
So this guy has been addicted to morphine for cancer he never had. and going through chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is no joke. That's not an easy thing to go through either. For a year under this misdiagnosis, it's possible that when his father started figuring it out and questioning Dr. Shipman about it, he had to be removed from the equation too.
Is this even a difference? We talked about how he has these patients dying. Many of them, especially getting into the 90s, were dying from morphine injections, we believe. This is the doctor that's supposed to care for you that had, you know, made a vow to do no harm. And here he is murdering people. But this is a straight up like hit, right?
Yeah. There was an actual event where he went to Jim's house to give him morphine. And his wife, Deborah, was like, no more drugs, no more morphine. You need to give him antibiotics. We need to prescribe him other things because he's not getting out of bed. He's having all these issues. And Deborah actually feels like she saved his life that day because that was the day that Shipman was coming to murder him. Not only did Jim's father pass away under mysterious circumstances around Shipman, but both of his aunts. So Jim had to go through this horrible tragedy of being told he has cancer and he only has like 18 months to live, be addicted to morphine, and then he loses several members of his family, all because of Shipman. So any idea or any speculation of he was just helping the elderly move along is completely blown out of the water now. What he did to Jim, I personally think one of the most horrifying things, because it's torture. It's just absolute psychological and physical torture. And Jim lives. And he sued, of course, and he won £260,000 to be paid out, you know, for being misdiagnosed with cancer.
Misdiagnosis of cancer, that's just another way for Shipman to get away with what he wants. And there's this pattern over time of he's even prescribing morphine for patients who've never taken it. And this all comes out at trial. The defense really has no way to deal with this. Not really. Because the amount of evidence against Shipman, the amount of witnesses that the prosecution is bringing forward is extraordinary to me. Because these patients, they range in ages, but many of them are elderly. But they're patients of his who are still around to talk. And they're coming out and saying, well, I didn't take morphine. And then the prosecution saying, ah, but we have these prescriptions for morphine with your name on them. And they'll say, well, I never took it. I never had morphine. This is a pattern of Shipman getting more and more drugs and trying to cover it up by saying, oh, but this is going to that patient. This is going to that patient. This patient has cancer. They need more morphine. Or I'm doing this surgery. They need morphine. He had a patient die in the surgery room. Shipman's excuse was, well, they must have taken that large dose of morphine when I had walked out of the room. And yeah. This is, again, we could go through and spend, I don't know how many episodes on this, but we could literally just spend, I think probably 4 episodes just going through the known victims. And let's talk the numbers, Justin, because this trial is obviously not going to go in his favor. But when you talk about victims, we've gone over different serial killers who have 14 victims or 24 or 36.
Yeah.
In the case of Dr. Shipman, we're talking minimally, probably what, 218?
Yeah. And this is my whole problem with H.H. Holmes' story is they gave him this unbelievable amount of victims. And I just could not wrap my head around it. I wouldn't believe it. I'm like, there's something wrong with this story. But when it comes to Dr. Shipman, and when you hear numbers up into the 300s, well, this is a doctor. He has access to lethal drugs. He has the paperwork to document it as a natural death of some type, and he has the means of disposing of the body. This is unlike a regular serial killer who has to go hunt a victim down, break into their house, put themselves in harm's way, then murder them by some means, and then dispose of their body in an illegal manner or leave their body without leaving a trace of evidence. This guy has all the opportunity, all of the tools in place. And being that he started back in the 70s and 80s, there weren't any checks and balances to catch on to what he was doing. So when we talk about over 200 victims, that is a conservative number. And he had very few survivors. Jim, the misdiagnosis of cancer, was one of them. Another was a woman named Elaine Oswald had come in and was complaining about a mild stomach ache. Okay. This isn't, I'm dying, I'm bleeding to death. This is a stomach ache. Shipman told her that we'll lay down and we'll take care of you. And that's kind of the last thing she remembers was seeing Shipman approaching her with a hypodermic needle. And then the next thing she knows, she's lying on the floor. She's in a bedroom. She's bleeding from the mouth. She can't breathe. And all the people in the room are shaking her and slapping her and trying to get her to wake up. But all she wants to do is keep sleeping. I wonder why. And Shipman will later claim that she suffered an allergic reaction. And then he will follow up with her in the hospital and keep checking on her to make sure she's okay. And they buy it. They believe it. But now we know better.
When you're dealing with hundreds of victims, and as Justin said, talking about the contrast here with H.H. Holmes, who had a murder castle, but, you know, maybe killed, I don't know, maybe 17 people. This is hundreds. He had a murder office. We know he murdered hundreds of people. The reason we can't get a definitive number is because there were cremations. There were bodies that by the time they were exhumed were in too poor a shape to really figure out what had happened. On their side, on the prosecution side in the trial, is the fact that morphine doesn't just decay. It doesn't go away. So as long as they have something left of the body that has morphine in it, they can find it. So that's helpful.
Especially when it's a overdose amount. You know, if it was a regular dose, it might be harder to detect. But when he's shooting them up with a whole syringe full, there's going to be a lot left.
There are so many stories that people shared of possibly witnessing attempts on people's lives. You know, a pillow over a child's face, or Dr. Shipman saying, I'm going to have to give them some, give them this drug now because they're not doing well. And then saying, wait a minute, they were just fine. I was just in here earlier. They were fine. Because there's no central reporting authority for all of these complaints, he was allowed to kill and kill again because there was no one that was united to stop him. It was impossible. You have one family in Hyde and another one in Yorkshire. These people aren't reporting these crimes to the same authority. So over time, there are complaints. There are people who are concerned about what might be going on with Dr. Shipman and his patients, but there isn't just one police department that is getting all these complaints and putting it together and stopping him.
And sometimes it's not even the police. It's they're reporting him to a hospital. They're reporting him to another doctor. And as we know, the investigations, especially by the medical boards, didn't go anywhere at first. There are police interviews with Dr. Shipman online. You can find him on YouTube. When he does interact with the police officers, he speaks down to them. He behaves as if he's superior, as he does. And then as they start pulling out photographs of his victims, he turns away from the table. He like turns his chair backwards, and it's a tiny little office that they're in. And he kind of crunches up and closes his eyes so he doesn't have to look at the photos that they show him. And he stops answering any questions. It's like childlike behavior. To me, I interpret it as he's not willing to accept the horrors that he's put upon others. Others that were backing him at the time were saying, well, he just doesn't want to deal with the police because he thinks he's innocent. And I'm like, no, this is a complete and utter disassociation, much like when his mother or father died.
Well, when he did that, and I think that's a major point in this case, this is something that really needs to be looked at. When we ask ourselves, why did he do this? What's his motivation? When he turns away and doesn't want to look at the victims, this isn't something that he wants to share with the authorities. And this is common with serial killers. If they're captured, well, where did you put these bodies? Did you murder this person? They don't want to help the police out. this is for them only. This is a very private thing for them. It's their pleasure and they're not sharing it. And that's what I got out of it. I don't think he wants to share this with the authorities. He knows damn well what he did. And I think he reveled in it. That's why there were so many of them. He was able to wield that power. He got away with hundreds of murders, hundreds of deaths, and they're beneath him. Why does he need to answer to them? Yeah. Dr. Shipman, when it comes down to the verdict, is found guilty on 15 counts of murder and one count of forgery. And he's sentenced to life in prison.
Now, that's all they could truly hit him with. But they didn't bother charging him with all the other murders or attempts at murder because they didn't want to overwhelm the jury. They don't want to overwhelm the court with this. So they just took their 15, we got them, and went with those. I think it was pretty obvious at that point that he wasn't going to be able to wiggle out of this one.
Now, because he had so great a means and so great an opportunity to kill patients, this needs to be rectified. And there's an inquiry. And the inquiry sets out to discover what went wrong, why he was able to operate in this manner for so long and kill so many people, so that in the future, medicine can be put back where it was supposed to be, which is do no harm, care for these patients, put them first. This is just a complete lapse here. Now, why is that? Well, in the inquiry, this is where they're able to discover exactly, at least conservatively, how many people died at the hands of Dr. Shipman and how. Early on in the 70s, when he was first practicing medicine, it's believed that he was just using whatever drugs that he had on hand. And then over time, he went with the morphine because he was able to overprescribe it or prescribe it for patients who would never receive that medicine. So he always had a supply on hand when he would give an injection of morphine. And if it was for a patient that legitimately needed it, he could give them a lot because he had extra supplies of it. So this is not just murder. There are all kinds of criminal activities involved with Dr. Shipman's activities because of the lapses and because so many people died and you have so many people in an uproar. And because this guy's the doctor and doctors are so well regarded and respected and looked up to and so depended on, this changes the way the UK handles regulation of medicines, of doctors. And this is a good thing. This is the system reacting and saying, we're going to get this right now. Some of the things that allowed him to get away with what he did was he could solely record the cause of death for each of his deceased patients. There was no verification. And because of that, he could write down whatever he wanted. He could write down, they had cancer or they had shallow breathing. He could write down whatever he wanted and there would be no question. There's no system in place at the time to track the disposal or use of prescription drugs. So Shipman was able to obtain diamorphine, which is his morphine of choice, again and again and again to kill his patients. No one's looking to see, well, how much do you have on hand? And, you know, you dispose of this. Where are the records of that? And there was no follow-up. Again, because there were complaints made against Shipman over time, over years, due to concerns about his treatments, the complaints were being handled by different agencies. There's no way to see the pattern. There's a pattern here. And it was there all along. It's just, you know, unless you have one department working on it, it's just spread out everywhere. So you might have someone say, well, yeah, I'd heard a complaint about him. Someone said he was rude to this patient and he gave them too much Valium. Well, that's not exactly going to start a criminal probe here. And the coroner is not investigating these deaths. It was beneficial to him in two ways. One, his victims were just buried or cremated, no questions. And two, he could be paid for completing the cremation authorization form, ash cash. So he's not only taking people out who either he doesn't want to deal with or, I'm deciding I'm going to kill them, whatever his motivation is, but then he's also profiting on top of it.
Yeah, it's said that he took pleasure in writing the letter to the families, informing them that their loved ones had been deceased, and that he took pleasure in watching them read it if they were ever present. It's real morbid stuff. He is sentenced to life in prison. he was put on suicide watch. But then after a while, after years of being there, he was given a little bit more leniency. And he had scheduled visits with his wife, Primrose. He had a retirement fund set up. And of course, his wife is the beneficiary. If he were to die before the age of 60, it was 100,000 euros a year. But after 60, it would go down. Well, it was the eve of his 58th birthday, and he had scheduled a visit with his wife on the day of his birthday. Well, that night, he hanged himself in his cell so she would receive the larger amount of the payout. He had used his bedsheet and tied them around the bars of the cell at the Wakefield prison. He had been taken off suicide watch 18 months earlier. People question this a lot. They question his death. They feel like he was helped by the guards, or the guards would make sure that there were always sharp objects around for him to use to kill himself. But that wasn't exactly the case. He was on good behavior, so he never had a lot of outbursts in prison or issues with other prisoners or the guards. So he was treated well, but I don't see how the guards would have wanted to help him or his wife. If they were in the know of this payout, I think they would have wanted him to be kept alive until age 60 and then allowed him to do whatever. So I don't think this was a plan. I don't think this was any sort of conspiracy like the prison death of Israel Keyes, where there might have been some incompetence on the prison guards. In the case of Harold Shipman, it's pretty well documented. All the paperwork and everything shows that he was taken off suicide watch a year and a half before, and that he had a planned visit with his wife. So there was no indications that he was going to do this. If anyone dies in prison or under police custody, I think there's a problem that needs to be addressed, but in Harold's case, I don't see any malice on the side of the prison guards. I see this as pretty much out of the blue, and he took advantage of a situation.
Really, if you look at it objectively, Dr. Frederick Shipman didn't have any indication that he was going to take his own life. And one of the things he was actually writing to his family about was that the media was very interested in his story. Of course, he says that he's innocent, but the media is interested in his story. They want him to write a book. They want to develop shows about this. He seems to be in good spirits. So it's not as though he's acting strangely where they would say, we better keep an eye on him, or, oh, he's not going to be able to handle prison. No, remember, his past is he's an egotistical guy. For him to take his own life, it just seems unexpected. Now, his wife had stood by him the entire time. I've noticed from the very beginning, this is going back when fellow doctors first met her, but it seems as if there are people that have it out for her. And you could say, well, she was married to a serial killer. How didn't she know? There was a time where she was driving around different patients because of his pethidine addiction. But when I think about this, I don't really see how she would necessarily know. The only way I see that she would know is if he came home and got into bed with her at night and started telling her about the patient he murdered that day. In my opinion, this is very much Dr. Shipman doing this on his own for his own pleasure, not to share it with others.
I can understand her not seeing it while it's happening, but in this aftermath of him being maybe the worst serial killer with the highest body count, it's a little odd to me that she still won't accept that. I guess it's he never accepted responsibility. He never said he did anything wrong, and she's taking him at his word, but she's blind to all of the evidence against him. She's not looking at any of the substance, any of the content, and she's just taking the side of her husband. Denial ain't just a river in Egypt, right?
So I understand people are angry. They're angry at what Dr. Shipman did, and they don't like that Primrose was there all along supporting him, even during the trial. I think it's quite possible that she did come to realize exactly what he had done. But, and this is not an excuse, but in her position, this was her first love. This was her husband. This was the father of her children. Her whole life revolved around him. You know, despite all these terrible things I've read from people talking about her, saying she's frumpy, just describing her in awful ways, to me, she did a great job raising her children. She was very good to her family. And I just don't understand all the animosity. Sure, we can say her husband was an awful person. We could say she should know what now, especially what he had done. But this is painful. Sometimes things are so painful that we can't really come to terms with them. We talk about a body count. This is hundreds of people that died at his hands. What about his wife? I mean, that's got to be difficult too. So I'm not saying have sympathy for her, but I don't really get the animosity and the derogatory things that are said about her. I don't think it's necessary. Let's put the blame where it belongs. It belongs on Dr. Shipman.
So what do we do when our trust is broken, when a doctor or a police officer or anyone that we are told all our lives is this person that we go to for help? What do we do now? How are we supposed to feel about this person being maybe the worst serial killer, the worst possible monster we've ever encountered? How do we take that? And it's because of our respect, our honor, our putting this person on a pedestal that allowed them to get away with it. I guess the silver lining here, because I try to find one, I don't always want to have an unhappy ending. Because of some of the precautions and protocols put in place because of this doctor, there was another man, Colin Norris, who was caught after murdering four elderly patients that he took care of in a nursing home. That was in 2002. He was only able to get away with four before they caught him. And he was injecting them with insulin when they weren't diabetic and injecting them with large enough amounts that it would crash their sugar, their blood levels, and stop their breathing. And of course, he maintained his innocence and fought with investigators and never admitted to any wrongdoing. But they had him on video, they had him signing out the insulin, and then the patient would be dead. And they're a lot faster to respond to it now.
Yeah, that's the benefits of the inquiry. And it just shows that there are people that care. There are people that are willing to do the hard work to make the changes necessary to fix a broken system. And this system was definitely broken. And sometimes you can't tell if something's broken until it's thrown in your face. And in this case, with, you know, well over 200 deaths, possibly into 280 deaths that were caused by Dr. Shipman, it warrants a change of the system. And that's putting it mildly. But yeah, I mean, when it comes down to it, if you can't trust your doctor, who can you trust? The best way for people to recover from this, from their worldview being shattered, is to have a system that responds. And the UK definitely did this. They responded. They did the inquiries. If you want to read them, go to the National Archives. It's at webarchive.nationalarchives.gov.uk. And there, look for the Shipman Inquiry. You'll find out about all the horrible things that Dr. Shipman did, all the suspicions that people had. It really is a very, very fascinating group of documents here. And there are a lot of them. This is, in my opinion, one of the best responses I've ever seen. You could say it's late, but I understand how they got there. I understand why it took so long. And really, you have to credit the people that did the hard work to try and turn this all around. And hopefully, it restores the faith back in the people. Angela Woodruff, if it wasn't for her, I don't know how much longer he would have killed, would have been killing, because it's the fact that she stopped everybody and said, wait a minute. Okay, we have a forged will here. We have a woman in good health who's suddenly dead, who's found in the wrong chair. We know how particular people are. We know their habits. We know their behaviors. When all of this doesn't add up, and then the authorities do the right thing and start getting permission to exhume bodies, this is how it all ended. if it wasn't for Angela Woodruff, I don't know. I mean, how long would he have been killing for? Might have still been killing today.
During my research, I was trying to find the victims' names, the ones he was charged with. So I had just typed in Dr. Death's victims. And I found a page that actually listed out all of the suspected victims. And you have to scroll through about 10 pages of names. So if she hadn't have stopped him, I can only imagine how much longer that list would have been.
And that brings up the question, did he do the forgery of the will just to have some money? Or was he planning to get away?
It doesn't appear that he felt any pressure. I don't feel that he had any inkling that anyone was smart enough or capable of stopping him. He was an arrogant bastard.
And that's exactly right. We've read from so many different sources that he was probably planning to get away. He was planning this this big windfall, and then he would just go away. But I don't know. With that kind of ego, I don't see him running. I don't see that at all.
Yeah, the whole idea was because of some of these inquiries, he felt the pressure and that he was going to take off, but no.
With the number of victims that Dr. Shipman had, he's certainly one of the worst serial killers we've ever seen. It's just that he didn't operate where he had to go hunt his victims down. They came to him. Because he had his own practice for a while, it was just that much easier to conceal the murders. It's a horrifying thought that you have this doctor who, when he started his own practice, brought thousands of patients with him. They donated tens of thousands of pounds in funds to get new equipment for his office. I mean, they literally trusted him to death.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid.
Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.